Hey, it is 8:06 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio and I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Today, what about the biggest lies in foreign policy? You know, what do we as citizens, what kind of power do we have to actually control the direction that our country goes and the money that we spend to destroy cultures and people in other countries? The death this week of diplomat Richard Holbrook offers an amazing window into the biggest lies in U.S. foreign policy. And our guest this morning is Stephen Zunis. Hey, Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, chair of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. And anyone who has been on the interwebs this week has seen Stephen's commentary in Truthout. Richard Holbrook represented the worst of the foreign policy establishment. Not mincing many words there. It's interesting.
Not, you know, I hate to speak ill of the dead, but
yeah.
I was pretty upset at that the unqualified praise that we've been hearing from all sorts of circles, including some fairly progressive ones that really overlook some rather sordid aspects of his career.
Absolutely sorted. And it's remarkable, too, Stephen, because the first thing that I saw about it was the obituary in the New York Times, which appeared December 13th. I think that was Monday night. And there were a lot of, I'm going to say, lies and distortions that have come out of just this one piece, okay? He's described as, you know, a lion of diplomacy, the Obama administration's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2009, a diplomatic troubleshooter who worked for every Democratic president since the late 60s and oversaw the negotiations that ended the war in Bosnia. That's one that people refer to time and time again, the negotiations that ended the war in Bosnia, and we'll get to that in a minute. One of the interesting things that came out of this obituary that also took root on the internet was this lie that just before Richard Holbrook was rolled into surgery, he said to the surgeon in the hallway, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." And that was first printed in this particular New York Times obituary that appeared Monday. And yesterday afternoon, the authors of the obituary basically posted a correction that when Holbrook said to this doctor, "You've got to stop the war," he, in fact, he was joking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of shocking as well. So now, Stephen, you've been writing about Holbrook for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about who he was, really? I mean, he wrote one of the volumes of the Pentagon Papers that was leaked, you know, generations ago. So talk a little bit about how deep are the roots of this guy.
His first assignment after graduating from Brown University and joining the Foreign Service was in South Vietnam in the Mekong Delta in the notorious counterinsurgency campaign there, which was not only incredibly brutal in terms of the attacks on the civilian population, essentially driving people out of their land they'd lived on for many, many generations, and you know, killing those that refused to move along. But you know, it's kind of inauspicious, given what a failure that that was from a counterinsurgency point of view, that he would be become Obama's special emissary to Afghanistan, as we found ourselves dragged down in yet another bloody counterinsurgency war in Asia. But the period I looked at the most was actually under the Carter administration, when he was named Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia. Now, Carter, in my view, has been a better ex-president than the president. His support for human rights was more in rhetoric than reality, but he had a little more concern than most presidents up to that time. And but basically he didn't have a lot of background, so people like Holbrooke had a lot of influence on him. And among the things he pressured Carter to do, against Carter's better judgment, in my view, was that it was to back these notorious dictators that we were supporting in Southeast Asia, including Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines, who had a brutal martial law regime, but most notably Suharto in Indonesia. Now, this is barely a year after Indonesia invaded East Timor, the Portuguese colony that was just becoming independent, and Holbrooke got Carter to increase military aid to Indonesia by 79%, which included counterinsurgency weaponry like the OV-10 Bronco and the like, and enabled them to engage in a scorched earth policy, ended up resulting in the deaths of nearly 200,000 people, close to a third of the island's population. And Holbrooke tried to cover it up. I mean, he testified before Congress when someone asked him about the reports of all these deaths from starvation and everything else. He said, it's Portuguese colonial neglect. You know, that it was a legacy of the Portuguese colonialists. It wasn't, didn't have anything to do with the U.S.-backed Indonesian occupation. Another really telling time when he was in this position was in South Korea. Chun Doo-hwan, a general, had seized power as dictator, and there's this pro-democracy uprising in the city of Gwangju. And Chun wanted to repress it, but most South Korean troops at that time were under U.S. command up near the border with North Korea. And so he requested that the U.S. release the South Korean troops so he could go down and suppress this uprising. And it was similar to a request actually made by Syngman Rhee, the dictator back in the 1950s, and President Dwight Eisenhower, Republican, had the good sense to say no. You know, we want these troops there to protect from the communists, not to engage in internal repression. But Holbrooke convinced the Carters to do otherwise and indeed helped facilitate the release of the South Korean troops, which went down and engaged in a massacre. Hundreds of people were killed. I mean, it was almost as bad as Tiananmen Square in China 9 years later. This is the kind of thing basically, this is a guy who has very little respect for human rights, very little respect for international law.
And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We are on the phone with columnist and Professor Stephen Zunis, looking at the legacy of Richard Holbrooke. Of course, Democracy Now! Just devoted their program to it as well. And that was a super interesting program in that with Amy Goodman, John Pilger, I love John Pilger, and Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy Scahill himself, I think John Pilger too, literally hounded Holbrooke about some of these issues within the past 10 years or so. And there's a famous clip of the 1999 International Press Club event in which I think Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill won an award. And Jeremy Scahill, as the Morning News director was just relating to me a few minutes ago, he cornered Holbrooke in a corner with his radio microphone and just started rapid firing about these very same things. You know, what about East Timor? You know, what about the Philippines? And Holbrooke denied, he's always denied it. He denied all these things till the bitter end. And Stephen, so for our listeners today, here's one of the things that really, I think is what really makes this issue of Holbrooke's death and the WikiLeaks cables, it makes them really important because people who are just regular people, like our listeners right now, me, the engineers here in the engineering room who are all staring at me right now, we all have a responsibility to try to grab control of these homicidal maniacs. I mean, I'm just putting that out. And when you look at what's happening in the world right now, people like Holbrooke, working with Jimmy Carter to oppress people all over the world, and now Obama, as we're looking at how much of our national budget goes to the war, it's insane. And here was Obama, who was this great diplomatic, Democratic Party golden boy, and now we're all looking at him. He's dirtied up. He's no different than all the others were, Stephen. And so what I really want to get to today, and I want to encourage people to call and talk about, is how do we as citizens, regular people, change these kind of situations? Because there's got to be something that we, the people, can do about it. And to watch someone like, some character like Holbrooke, for generations perpetrate this kind of stuff, there's got to be some way that regular people can have an impact on it. Anyway, the number to call in, 503-231-8187. You know, what should we, regular people, do to try to get some handle on these despicable characters in our foreign policy that are ruining our country as they kill people in their large numbers, you know, all around the world, it seems like. I don't think I'm exaggerating, Stephen. Can you bring this issue home to our own local neighborhoods? Why do we care, and what can we do about it, do you think?
Well, there's always been incongruity between America's self-perception and America's role in the world. I mean, I'm surprised that some of the WikiLeaks things has so many people shocked and upset, because, you know, I've read these, you know, cables, when they, in the National Archives, 30 years after they were declassified or whatever, and you know, they're this is the kind of arrogance that the United States has carried around for years. I mean, the only one who'd be really surprised by this are those who believe that the United States is this benign, respectful power that is not an empire, you know. That and this is sort of the kind of arrogance that Holbrooke showed. Comes throughout. I remember when he was Clinton's assistant secretary of state for European affairs. This is back during the height of Turkey's repression against the Kurds. Many thousands of civilians were getting killed. Journalists were being jailed. Death penalty was in frequent use. I mean, Turkey's cleaned up its act somewhat now, but back then it was pretty bad. To be a member of the European Union, you need to be a democracy. You need to respect human rights. You can't have the death penalty. There's certain criteria like that. And here was Holbrooke demanding that the Europeans let Turkey in anyway, and this is so typical of this kind of attitude the United States has, that we can sort of tell people what to do. When he was a Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations, the UN tried to pass a resolution that criticized Israel using helicopter gunships to fire into crowds of demonstrators, and saying you can't go killing civilians like this. Occupying power has certain responsibilities in the Fourth Geneva Convention, and basically Holbrooke said that this takes the United Nations out of the running of having any role in the peace process. Unlike the United States, which supplied these helicopter gunships and supported these massacres, we were somehow more credible in being the broker for Middle East peace. Americans are certainly proud of their country and for good reasons in many cases. I think most Americans have a sense of fair play that we really don't have a right to go around telling other countries what to do. We shouldn't be supporting occupiers, whether they be Indonesia or Israel or Morocco or anybody else, just because they happen to be strategic allies. We shouldn't support dictators like in South Korea and Philippines and suppress their own people. I think a lot of it has to do with just getting people to know about these things, educate people about these things. But unfortunately, the media's whitewash of Holbrooke's history is really a exhibit A of the problem we have here.
It's insane, Stephen. So, okay, now I just pulled this off of the New York Times blog this morning, and we do have a couple callers. We'll go to them in just a second. It's called The Lead. It's the New York Times breaking news blog that Robert Mackey writes. And he, late last night, he posted drew attention to the correction that the two obituary writers, one of them Karen DeYoung, right, Okay, so this is how the obituary ended. That was published, in Tuesday's Washington Post is what it was. As Mr. Holbrook was sedated for surgery, family members said his final words were to his Pakistani surgeon, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." But the correction that the Post filed, basically, they had to say that Mr. Holbrook had apparently been joking in a conversation with a doctor who was Egyptian, not Pakistani. And so when we're talking about the disinformation, I mean, it's stunning. It's stunning. Yeah. Just simple, basic incompetence. But here, we need to go to a couple of our callers really quick. We have Thomas on the line. Thomas, what can we do to bring these foreign policy issues home and put some of the power back in our own hands?
Well, good morning. This is a wonderful program. Your guests' comments are amazingly insightful. Lisa, I think we're in a bit of a conundrum, aren't we? Because if we think about using the normal channels that we would as citizens of choosing to vote for leaders and parties that do not support such expansionist and interventionist policies, then we flat run out of viable parties, it looks like to me. And so I guess I would hope that if nothing else, we can choose the option of buying out of the false narrative, buying out of the fiction that somehow that there's a huge difference in the intrinsic deep foreign policy agendas of both of these corrupt political parties. And I guess I'd like to make a brief, question, and that would be to your guests, and that would be, can't we really consider Mr. Holbrook as just one of a number of figures from the past continuing to the in the present and the Democratic Party, the people that are powerful, who travel from administration to administration, who essentially carry the same torch? I mean, we can think about former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and the Clinton administration, who said, quote, "We raised the bar deliberately too high at Rambouillet," when she essentially admitting that there was no real negotiation to be had with Yugoslavia, that it was essentially a pretext for war. And then also, she was also quoted as, when asked if about the questions of the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children who died as a result.
Half a million, 500,000 babies,
incredible,
yeah.
Incredible, incredible. Yeah. Yes, ask about the result of these, the death of these Iraqi children as a result of these oppressive sanctions, says that she thought it was worth it. Yeah. And then, we don't even have to go back there. We can come right up to the Hillary Clinton administration.
Let me interrupt really quick and say, Hillary Clinton, so the WikiLeaks cables show that Hillary Clinton put out a directive that diplomatic corps people should be spying on people in the foreign offices that they are posted to, including trying to get credit card information and biometric data. What? What? I'm sorry, my outrage pops out.
No, go absolutely.
Ahead, Thomas.
Absolutely. And we look at, and the giant, the manhole lid has been lifted off the sewer recently, thanks to WikiLeaks, and people are forced to face such realities as the fact that now we see clearly that the State Department was admitting the embassy in Honduras was showing that that they clearly recognized that there was an illegal military coup against a democratically elected a government in Honduras, and this has been known from the beginning. And now we have these fraud elections in Haiti, and you're not a peep out of the White House. You have a suppression, the absolute suppression of the UN Goldstone report, which showed clearly that Israel was involved in systematic war crimes against the Palestinians. So I guess my question is, can't we really see with this collective retrospective hallucination about the history of Richard Holbrooke and his illustrious career as a warmonger, aren't we really shedding a light on something much deeper, on a continuity that exists to this day?
Great, Thomas. We got to go and let someone else have a chance. Let's just get to our next caller really quick, and that person is Jeff. Jeff, what's your take? I mean, what can we do on our community level to try to grab the control of our foreign policy back?
Well, Thomas makes a good point. We're kind of stuck here. You can bark up the tree of the authority structure, write a letter to your congressman and get a nice, pointless letter back. But frankly, I think we need to group together, get organized in a Gandhi-esque kind of peaceful way, and really seriously protest the building of the empire. Last time I checked, we had 737 military bases in other countries, not even counting the ones here. So that's pretty expensive, you know, in a time of lean economic...
austerity. Yeah.
Austerity times we're having now, that's a domestic policy people can seriously protest.
Right on.
You can go to the White House, you can take an organized group of people to the federal building, you can really get some attention focused where it needs to be focused.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to also make the point that the CIA was founded by Wall Street bankers and Richard Holbrooke and Hillary Clinton and all these yahoos are basically just water boys for them.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot.
This
is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Our guest this morning, Professor of Politics and International Studies from the University of San Francisco, Stephen Zunis. And if you have been on the internet at all this week, you saw his commentary on Truthout. Richard Holbrooke represented the worst of the foreign policy establishment. And, you know, we usually don't bring big foreign policy issues, onto this show, because I want to focus on people, regular people, what we can do and what we should be doing to make the world a better place. But, I mean, Stephen, again, I keep coming back to this issue of when it comes to this establishment, I know that people, regular people, voting people, taxpaying people, we feel so beaten down by it that we feel that there's nothing that we can do.
Let me address that, actually, because...
Yeah.
I mean, I think East Timor is a really, really good example, and that you had both Republican and Democratic administrations, you know, supporting this brutal occupation. You had people
supporting it and
covering up for it. And, you know, by almost any definition of realpolitik or how one would see an empire, there was no way the United States was going to stop this repression. And the U.S. wasn't alone. Australia and Britain and other powers were supporting Indonesia as well. And yet global civil society, very much here in the United States and Britain, Australia, and elsewhere, refused to let the issue die. Human rights groups, church groups, others mobilized, press the issue. And basically it embarrassed these governments, shamed these governments, to the point that it became politically difficult to support the occupation anymore. And when Indonesia's economy tanked in 1998, these governments said to the Indonesian regime, you know, we'd like to help you guys out, but this East Timor thing is making it politically impossible. This half an island is not worth it to you, given what's at stake here.
Mm.
And so, as a result, East Timor is now free. And we've seen this on regarding South Africa, you know, and when these U.S. government and others are saying, oh, the benign influence of foreign capital will gradually bring freedom to South Africa, but people demanded sanctions and eventually got them. And we look at Central America, Vietnam, other nuclear arms race, you know, where popular movements really did make a difference. But let me just mention something about the people power in general. And this is another legacy about Holbrooke a lot of people don't realize, is that after the Dayton Accords, He decided that Milosevic was our guy, that he was a key to stability. And when the people of Serbia and this nonviolent movement, freedom, tried to rise up against him, we backed Milosevic when he suppressed it. And in Kosovo, there is a largely nonviolent movement led by Ibrahim Rugova, a moderate nationalist movement wanting independence from Serbian control. And we, again, the Milosevic, convinced Clinton to back Milosevic. Well, anyway, the repression in Kosovo got so bad that the nonviolent movement was eclipsed by this radical, violent, chauvinistic group known as the Kosovo Liberation Army. And then if we set up this trap in Rambouillet, you know, where we ended up going to war and essentially brought the KLA to power, which is a pretty hardcore group. In fact, just yesterday, their prime minister was implicated in smuggling human organs and all sorts of criminal activity. Meanwhile, the bombing campaign successfully led, or at least initially, led the regime to suppress the pro-democracy movement, which was springing up again. Well, what happened eventually, of course, about a year and a half later, the pro-democracy movement did succeed in doing nonviolently from within what 11 weeks of NATO bombing could not do in overthrowing the Milosevic, the butcher of the Balkans. Now, I've worked some with the leaders of OTPOR. This is a student movement. They're like in their mid-20s at the time. And they hate Holbrooke. I mean, they say if it weren't for Holbrooke, they could have brought down Milosevic years earlier. Kosovo would be autonomous under a moderate group. They would not have had that war in 1999. I mean, that they these are and it came down to again another way that Holbrooke implemented U.S. foreign policy is that they underestimate the power of ordinary people to make change. They figure the United States, we swing between these extremes of appeasement and war. And we did to Milosevic, what we did with Manuel Noriega and Saddam Hussein. We ended up, supporting them to a point where they start doing all this crazy stuff. Then we flip to the other extreme, saying, oh, we have no choice, we go to war.
Yeah, I want to jump in there for a minute there, Stephen, and I want to make a couple points, and then we'll go to the callers. We have a whole bunch of callers, and the number is 503-231-8187. On Democracy Now! Last week, again, I mean, I keep coming back to WikiLeaks and Anonymous, the 4chan anarchists. The WikiLeaks cables, a number of people have said to me that they think that the WikiLeaks cables are really not news and that they don't see any real big headlines coming out of there. And it always shocks me, but I think it's the quality of reporting about that. And you'll notice that television news, which is where most people still get their news, Fox News, these people on television are not covering the substance of what is in those cables that have been released. And in fact, it's Fox News and a couple other talking hairdos on TV that have called for assassination of the WikiLeaks guy, right? So, which is really interesting to me. Again, that issue of the, like you were saying, Stephen, like a big thing that we can do is make sure that people are educated about what's happening out there. But it strikes me that, as Thomas and Jeff talked about, we're talking about how can people have an impact on the foreign policy. I'm just saying, to me, it looks like Anonymous, right? The 4chan anarchists, those people are like the Earth First of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And it's a different concept in protest. It's a different concept in direct action that I think is really remarkable. And and here's one other thing I wanted to bring up. As you were talking about, the power that Holbrooke has had to literally retard the development of a democracy, and I mean that in the classic dictionary definition of that word. Democracy Now! Interviewed, I think it was last week or the week before, during the climate change summit in Cancun, Democracy Now! Amy Goodman interviewed the president of Ecuador. And she talked about the WikiLeaks cable that detailed how the United States diplomatic corps tried to bribe and blackmail, I think, seven small countries a year ago at the climate change summit in Copenhagen, which was the biggest one that had the big leaders of governments there, and Obama went there. The United States, first they tried to blackmail or bribe these countries into signing off on the climate change agreement, but they wouldn't do it. And then when these certain countries didn't agree, and Ecuador was one of them, then the United States diplomatic corps threatened them. And specifically with Ecuador, there was a cable that said, basically, they sent out to Ecuador, you guys better watch out. And within a few months, there was a failed coup attempt, right? A failed coup attempt against the Ecuadorian government. So Amy Goodman interviews the president of Ecuador, and she says, well, aren't you angry at Obama? Because you have this, famously good relationship with Obama, and you think he's really cool. And the president of Ecuador said, actually, the government does not control the United States and what it does. Mm-hmm. A small, entrenched group of business interests that have deep roots in the apparatus behind government. That's who controls what happens in the United States. And he said he didn't have any problems with Obama because he knows that Obama does not call the shots. And when Richard Holbrooke died, that was the first thing I thought of, was that concept and establishment. And Thomas and Jeff, both our callers, they touched on that as well. And I just had to put that out there. Maybe the nature of direct action is changing, and our younger generation is learning how to literally go to the digital beating hearts of some of these fascinating agencies and institutions that they see as being instrumental. I saw where the Swedish prosecuting attorney's office website was taken offline for 11 hours yesterday. Anyway, this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland. We're talking about the real legacy of Richard Holbrooke and what can local communities do to take back our foreign policy and have some impact on our government. And we do have a caller on the line. Joanne's on the line. Joanne, what do you think about it?
Well, Lisa, I've been thinking that a big part of this ongoing problem with diplomacy and war, and that has to do with that we're not doing anything about pulling out the roots of these bullies. I think it's because we support bullies in our home, in school, in the police department. We support intellectual bullies. And, you know, I think that's a big part of this, this ongoing problem is that we support these bullies of all kinds, and unless we get uncomfortable and really work on that part of this issue, I don't think you're going to get anywhere with war or diplomacy or anything. Goodbye.
That was an interesting point that Joanne just made, because one of the obituaries that I read, I think it was the Associated Press obituary on Holbrooke, described him as the sledgehammer or something like that. And it basically listed it was a laundry list of the ways that U.S. presidents, especially Democratic presidents, had literally used him as a weapon against foreign governments, pushing foreign governments. And the word bully definitely appeared in that article. And we have another caller. We have Michael on the line. Michael, what do you think? What should we, the people, be doing to bring back our foreign policy and try to change the nature of what our government does around the world?
I think we have to be willing to fight this thing on a generational level. We keep wanting to over and over and over the proverbial do the same thing and expect different results. The system that has been set up and continually is adjusted, for instance, by removing organizations like ACORN from the mix, and then introducing the Tea Party and touting it in the corporate media as the new People's Party, when actually the Working People's Party was coming up out of ACORN, but that wasn't being talked about. It was, the people, what they want is the Tea Party. What I think we need to do is to stop reacting to all of the latest disaster topics of the day and take hold of an agenda as a group, the cohesive group that we used to have, like in the 60s, religion, women, blacks, whites, everybody was together to fight this thing. Environmental groups grew out of that. Now everything's all split up. I think, I'm talking pressured because there's not enough time, but I think what we need to do is to join together generationally, pick a topic, for instance, instant runoff elections. And much like the Tea Party is being able to manipulate Republican wishes, if we had a system set up like instant runoff elections, a lot of middle-of-the-road people wouldn't be afraid to vote for who they want, because then the next person, if they voted for Dennis Kucinich, then the next person might be Osama, and they would get that, Obama, and they would get that vote to count. So many people, I even heard yesterday, are afraid that if they try to do this again, maybe someone like Sarah Palin would win. And we give up too easily. We figure, that didn't work, so now we're hopeless. If we don't set up a system like instant runoff elections, we don't really have a choice. We don't have a voice. We can't have any power in any topic that exists out there.
It's an interesting point. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you.
And the number to call, 503-231-8187. You know, Michael raises a couple points that I've been thinking about a lot lately, too, is when you look at the rise of the Tea Party, you look at the meteoric popularity of Sarah Palin. The left doesn't have a Sarah Palin, right? And Michael Moore has been the closest thing, maybe, to someone like that. And he, without the backing of the major commercial television networks, I'm putting that out, television networks, I feel as though that somehow is a key tool in who garners the support of regular people like us. And I know so many people around the Tea Party to me, when you listen to some of the things that the Tea Party says, they're the same things that I hear on KBOO, right? It's like an angry libertarian, but without any left-leaning anchor. That's the way this group, this community of people, is being pulled to the right, which fascinates me. And not only that, Glenn Beck, right? Glenn Beck came out last week or the week before, and he broadcast and said he actually admires the WikiLeaks guy. Because he basically said he was torn on that issue of what should happen to the WikiLeaks guy. Because the WikiLeaks guy, Julian Assange, he is a cranky libertarian. But that Glenn Beck said, obviously, Julian Assange is not a big fan of government, and neither am I. So I just thought that was major. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. And we do have a couple more callers. But, Stephen, I want to ask Stephen. We've been talking over Stephen for a while. Stephen, what about this issue of the Democratic Party and the so-called kind of liberal institutions that have presided over some of these worst, most egregious foreign policy debacles? I mean, we always want to demonize the Republicans, but it's like Michael just said, people really on the left in this country don't even have roots in the Democratic Party. We don't know what the Democratic Party's for.
Well, I mean, I think it's in many ways it's less important, you know, how we vote as the choices we give people once in office. And that, you know, I don't object to people engaging in strategic voting, you know, the Democrats, the lesser evil or whatever, as long as they do the real important work to keep them honest. And, you know, just a few minutes ago I was mentioning examples of of East Timor, of Central America, of South Africa, of Vietnam, you know, when in very, very few cases do even liberal, with a few notable exceptions, I should say, liberal Democrats take the lead on, you know, challenging empire, supporting peace and human rights. Usually they're dragged kicking and screaming by their constituents. And so I think the impetus ultimately, I mean, on the one hand, we shouldn't have any pretense that Democrats are qualitatively different than Republicans.
Right.
But at the same time, Democrats, you know, we can pressure them to change, which is more than you can say for the Republicans.
Right.
But again, I think the key is just applying the pressure.
Right. Excellent. And I do have to say really quickly, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, it's another episode of Die German Stunde. We love this show. This is radical. Our super cool friend, Miriam Widman, hosts, and they're looking at how immigrants who came to Oregon in the 1950s and 1960s get along with more recent immigrants. She's welcoming guests from the German, Iranian, and Italian communities of Portland. Dude, that's radical, and you should be listening to Miriam on that. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Food Show, it's John Boyd Jr., the president of the National Black Farmers Association. This is one of the biggest stories of the year that a lot of people are not following. He's got an update on the recent settlement won by black farmers. Also, a look at how the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act is going. Does the bill grant adequate exemptions to Oregon's many small farmers? And food science expert Harold McGee talks about his latest book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Food and Recipes. You know, that's something for people on a budget to listen to, because that's a really key thing. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We are on the phone with Stephen Zunes. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. His commentary this week, Richard Holbrooke represented the worst of the foreign policy establishment. We're doing that rare thing, talking about foreign policy, but we're looking at how do we, people on the ground in our own neighborhoods, how do we even begin to think about taking that back? And the number to call is 503-231-8187. And we have two callers. We have Brian on the line. Brian, what is your take?
Oh, God. Morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
Thank you. I'll try and stick to the point and be succinct, because I know there's people hanging on the line. And I lived in Indonesia in the Suharto era, and I think part of what we can do, I gave up on the major media a long time ago. I mean, this is the only country that I know of with any say in world affairs that could even take somebody like Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck seriously, and George W. Bush for that matter. So start with that level of, or that lack of depth of reporting. The good thing is that it's given birth to an amazing alternative media like Cable and Democracy Now! And David Barsamian's and so on. However, what I'm trying to say is, when I lived in Indonesia, the people, I didn't live in a white fenced off area. We lived right in the middle of several kampungs and became part of their community. What the people in Indonesia do, in the cities too, is they know right up front that the government doesn't give a damn about them. So what they do is they, each city and village or town is divided into kampungs, which are basically areas that aren't mapped but are well defined by the people themselves, and a headman is elected every 2 or 3 years, and the people that work give him so much of their earnings to distribute among the people that aren't working, and a lot of bartering goes on, and small gardening, and Java especially is incredibly fertile. If you drop a stick there, it'll start sprouting. And I was deeply impressed by that. I suppose it's called socialism in other countries, but we, and it is, we called it kampung socialism. Mm. And so there's somewhere we can start, and some of us at the coast are trying to do this by trading among ourselves, trading with the local farmers, buying and selling from them, and of course, reaching out into the further world. And so I think it starts at the grassroots because, as you say, even the Tea Party people, they know the government isn't on their side.
Yeah.
So they're just taking their anger out in any direction that is poked at them by the major media because they get addicted to television.
Mm, and it is interesting about that addiction to television point with that. And
yeah,
thanks a lot.
So it's, I mean, to me, it's we do things, as I say, kampung socialism and education, which is getting the shaft. If,
yeah.
If we had an educated population,
none of this could happen.
This is, yeah, and so that's my little example from personal experience. And then, and I've lived in quite a few banana republics, and that's what the people do. They, a lot of them don't pay taxes because they just distribute it among themselves.
Mm.
And one more thing, it's a totally different subject, and I'm asking a lot of people this because I was an architect for a long time, and I don't know if you've even looked at this, but in Iraq we have now the biggest U.S. embassy in the world, and it started a long time ago, the Green Zone. How the hell could they say that it was never intended to invade Iraq? Because that must have been planned years ahead. And I'd like to hear a whole show on that sometime.
That's a really interesting point. That that embassy in Iraq is so big, it's visible from space, from what I understand.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm familiar with the proposal, the bidding, the pre-design, all that stuff, and right through construction. I mean, this must have started in the early 90s, if not before. So that's
I want to say, Brian, email me some of that stuff. Let's do we could do a whole show on that. Why don't you email some of your contacts or information? We can find a guest who could come on and talk about that.
Yeah, I would.
That's totally interesting.
I will be in touch.
Great. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Brian. And I also want to say, next week on this show, next Wednesday, we're having people from the state of Oregon who are kind of creating a system, which is what Brian is talking about, where taxpayers can purchase shares in a pot of money that goes to send out loans to low-income Oregonians for college, housing, or other important things. And it also provides social services around the people that get the loans to show people the best way to budget and to be able to pay the loans back. It's a really super interesting program, and the state has launched it, and they need more people to invest in that program. So that's not going to be on this show next Wednesday. And we do have another caller. We got Stevie Ray on the line. Stevie Ray, what do you think?
Hi, Lisa. I have a a memory of when I was a kid growing up in Olympia, Washington. Well, I'd ride my bike 20 miles to get there, but we used to do like the graffiti art on little pieces of wood, and we'd hide them along the sidewalks for other people to find. And I was thinking the same kind of passionate response that I had to finding those items, and then I started looking for them, and I was thinking we could take podcasts from the archives of all of our favorite, like K Boozer, Alternative Radio, TUC Radio. We could do like a little bit of Right Wing and throw some OPB in there and make a disc, right, like a CD disc, and then we could honor the Patriots working now and put like Lady Gaga on the disc, and then put in parentheses like just kidding, and put them places, hide them in plain view, put them on poles like people do flyers. We could go into rural communities and hang them like Christmas ornaments, and people would find them, and then they could have their own personal response to it. It's not like I'm trying to proselytize to them or something, but
wow,
that was what got me passionate about this seeking. And so I thought, that sounds like something I should talk to Lisa about.
I'm thinking about that. I'm going to give that some thought. I like the idea of sidewalk spam, because that's kind of what that is.
It's like the Smarty Pants Secret Society or something.
Right. I like that idea. I'm thinking about that. All right. Bye. Thanks a lot, Steve Ray. And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. We are live on the phone with Stephen Zunes. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco. We're talking about the legacy, the real legacy of Richard Holbrooke, and this issue of how local communities, regular people like us, can take control of our foreign policy and try to bring control of our government back home. And we've covered a lot of territory, Stephen. Stephen?
Yes.
Anyway, Stephen, do you have a book that's coming out, upcoming?
I just had a book that was released on Western Sahara, which is like East Timor, a small country that on the verge of decolonization was invaded by a powerful neighbor with, in this case, Morocco, with U.S. Support. My famous book is Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. And I'm currently working on a book on U.S.-Israeli relations. But, you know, there's a common theme in a lot of these, and I think it is that despite what we're told about extremist violence coming out from those who hate our freedom, we don't get in trouble because of our values, but when we stray from those values, when we support dictatorships, when we choose war over diplomacy, when we end up backing dictators and sending lethal weapons all over the world, these are the kinds of things. When we support occupying armies, when we run roughshod over basic international legal principles, I mean, that is what gets us in trouble, not our freedom and democracy.
And
there's really no contradiction between a foreign policy that supports freedom and democracy and a foreign policy that looks after our national security interests. And I'm not talking about phony claims for freedom and democracy like Bush had, where we would say, let's bring democracy to Damascus, to Tehran, when he said nothing about democracy in Riyadh and Cairo. That is to say that he was using democracy as an excuse to undermine regimes that he didn't like, but we were propping up, other dictatorships that were just as bad. But I'm talking about, consistently, supporting the right of people to control their destiny, not just in terms of having democratic elections, but challenging the power of a corporate interest and others who would deny people their basic human rights.
It's so interesting. Now, we only have a few minutes left, so we're wrapping up now. And I'm kind of excited by the fact that you are a professor at over there in San Francisco, University of San Francisco. So you must be dealing with young people all the time.
Yeah.
And here in Portland recently, for some reason, Portland is considered to be a hotbed of terrorism for reasons that, well, we can all speculate about that. I think that when you have a lot of FBI agents in a place like Oregon, they have to come up with their own fun. I'll put it that way. But we recently had a teenager from Oregon State arrested and charged with terrorism on under really questionable circumstances. Even mainstream media sources are saying that the kid was probably entrapped, but that he probably, that probably is not going to help him in court. But when you are teaching the chair, you're the chair of the Middle Eastern Studies Department down there. What do you see in the young people, the young college students, and what, you know, what should we know about the generation of young people that's coming up and getting a college education now on these really hotbed topics?
Well, yeah, there seems to be a lot of skepticism. These are the people who grew up, in the course of the Iraq War, which I think most realize was based on lies. In my 20 years of teaching, there's been a big shift on Israel-Palestine. At least among students who've thought about it. I walk into a classroom 20 years ago and assumed everybody had a pretty strong bias. In support of the Israeli government, but now, if anything, it's the other way around. There's much more sympathy to the Palestinians and their situation. So on a whole number of levels, I think we are seeing a generation that is a little more willing to step back and be critical about the U.S. role in the world. The problem, though, is I think that in some cases skepticism has led to cynicism, and I think the job of an older generation is not to to primarily just tell people about how bad things are, but to talk about these case studies. I mean, for example, none of my students had any idea that American college students were critical in the downfall of apartheid, that it was the divestment campaigns on college campuses that made possible ending U.S. opposition to sanctions against South Africa.
Wow.
And sanctions against the apartheid regime were crucial in bringing it down. I had lunch in Italy 8 years ago with F.W. de Klerk, the last white president of South Africa, and he acknowledged it was sanctioned, along with the course of the resistance in the townships, et cetera. The sanctions were critical. And bringing down the system, and that whole movement really got its start on American college campuses, and students today don't know that.
Well, okay, so Stephen, we have to let it go there, but what I hear you saying, you've got this positive message about how people can take direct action and make a difference, and we have to guard against the cynicism. Stephen Zunis, thank you so much for being with us today. Stephen Zunis, read his commentary on truthout.org, read him in the National Catholic Reporter and on Common Dreams.
And on our website and on Huffington Post.
Great. Thanks a lot for being here, Stephen.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for Miriam Widman. You're listening to KBOO Portland.